Hello, welcome to Out in the Bay, queer radio from San Francisco. I'm Eric Jansen. This week, Robert Jones Jr., author of the New York Times instant bestseller, The Prophets, published January 5th, 2021. In his debut novel, Jones describes the romantic and tragic relationship between Samuel and Isaiah, two enslaved young men on a plantation in Mississippi before the onset of the Civil War. The Prophets has been called a lyrical and rebellious love story by the New York Times Book Review and a panoramic vision of love and cruelty by the New Yorker. It's much more than a love story. Told from numerous perspectives, The Prophets explores gender and sexuality, race, power, religion, and toxic masculinity in the antebellum United States. Robert Jones Jr. is a native of New York City. He received a BFA in creative writing with honors and an MFA in fiction from Brooklyn College. Although The Prophets is Jones's debut novel, he's certainly no newcomer to writing. His work has been featured in the New York Times, the Paris Review, Essence, and the Feminist Wire, among other publications. Jones is also the creator of The Son of Baldwin, a social justice social media community nearly 150,000 strong that sheds light on matters from a Black queer perspective. Robert Jones Jr., welcome to Out in the Bay, and congratulations on all the high praise for The Prophets.
Thank you so much. I'm so happy to be here.
Wonderful. Before you read a passage from The Prophets, if you could please tell us briefly, tell our listeners a little bit more about the book than I was able to say in the intro.
Absolutely. The Prophets is a story about Samuel and Isaiah, two young men enslaved on a plantation in Mississippi during the antebellum period who are in love. And The Prophets explores how that love transforms everyone around them, whether enslaver or enslaved, how it inspires, how it angers. And it also has a thread that takes us back even earlier in history to give Samuel and Isaiah's love a context and a lineage in pre-colonial Africa.
Great. I definitely want to talk about that as we get into our discussion. So tell us about the passage you're going to read for us, and please set up the context for this passage.
Absolutely. I'm reading from a chapter called Maccabees, and it is where Samuel and Isaiah are working together in a barn. It's where they normally work in, on the plantation, and they recently received some rather disturbing news. I won't spoil what that news is, but Maggie, another enslaved person who is an elder on the plantation, is bringing them something to eat as they receive this terrible news. And this is now Samuel and Isaiah, once Maggie leaves, sort of dealing with both of those things, the food they receive and the bad news.
"Timothy called for me," Samuel mumbled again. Isaiah took a deep breath and held it. He let it out. Then, because what else could he do? He shrugged. Silently, grief shook his body. "Don't," Samuel said, standing still in the same spot, holding the cloth in his left hand. "Don't what? Cry or shrug?" Isaiah didn't know, and he was too tired to ask. But he did think about the ways in which his body wasn't his own, and how that condition showed up uniquely for everyone whose personhood wasn't just disputed, but denied. Swirling beneath him were the ways in which not having lawful claim to yourself diminished you, yes, but in another way, condemned those who invented the disconnection. He hoped, maybe not in this realm, but absolutely in others, if there were others. Matching hard for hard did nothing but create wreckage. But being soft, while beautiful, was subject to being torn asunder by the harder thing. What other answer was there then, but to be some kind of flexible? Stretch further so that there was too much difficulty in trying to pull you apart. Samuel was a hard thing. There was no use in trying to make him anything other than that. And he had every right, even if sometimes he didn't understand how his rigidity, that impenetrable door that Pua was perhaps the first to notice, was built up in the wrong direction. But some people thought hard was the answer and believed that rather than bend, you had to try to snap them in half because they were confident that you couldn't. Isaiah, however, knew of the sporadic but attendant softness inside Samuel, ground cover rocky, yes, but soil giving. And Samuel only half trusted him with that knowledge, preferred, actually, if Isaiah didn't know it all. So some things he kept to himself. The shadow with the pointing hand would be one of them. It was in the barn. He could admit to that, but it wasn't in the woods or riding Maggie's back like a strapped babe. A mutual sigh released them from having to continue the argument. No one had to willingly relent or gloat over a victory. The inhalation, then exhalation of breath provided enough room for them both to hold on to a little bit of dignity, even in the middle of desecration. Samuel looked down at the bundle in his hand. He looked up and motioned with his head for Isaiah to follow him as he walked around to the back of the barn. Isaiah walked behind him, tracing Samuel's steps, walking in them sometimes and sometimes making his own path through the chicory and spurge. When they came to the rear center of the barn, where the sun was bright with anger and the knot hole that betrayed them was a kind of memorial, Samuel stopped. Isaiah walked a bit farther to where there was a little bit of shade because a yellow pine, not 30 years old yet, was in the process of spreading itself there, and he found its scent reassuring because of the way it hid his own. He turned to look at Samuel, moving against his nature because there was the possibility of an accusatory shadow. He walked over to where Isaiah was and sat down at the base of the tree. Isaiah sat down next to him. Samuel flattened his lap and unfastened Maggie's cloth. And what did they have here? A veritable feast of boiled eggs, fried ham, blackberry jelly on thick slices of bread, two whole nectarines, and a big old hunk of brown cake. "Mercy," Isaiah said. Samuel didn't want to remember the shadow he didn't see. He picked up a nectarine and gestured for Isaiah to take one for himself. Almost at the same time, they bit into them. The juices ran down their faces. Isaiah wiped the juice away, but Samuel didn't. He stared ahead at the rear of the barn. Neither of them spoke, but they each continued to eat, picking things from the cloth slowly, carefully, one with grateful hands, the other with discerning ones, like ritual, but without prayer, because they didn't need one, and respect was freely given. But still, it was solemn-like, holy, as unto a last supper.
Thank you. So a little bit more about that scene. Maggie works in the kitchen, and I think I just read the part before that section, and Samuel at first didn't want to accept the food, right? He was like, "I don't want to take any food from the big house." And she says, "Well, you want to starve?"
Samuel's very stubborn. He thinks that in his rebellion, he should rebel against any receiving anything from the people who enslave them. Even if it would benefit him, he does not want to take it. Isaiah, on the other hand, is more welcoming and more pragmatic. I think that is sort of what makes them endearing to me, is the ways in which one sort of makes up for the other in many ways. Samuel's courage, Isaiah's patience. I like the way those things work together.
So what led you to write this book? What was your inspiration for the prophets? I understood it's been taken, it's been a 14-year journey to get to the publication.
In undergrad, I was an Africana Studies minor. I majored in creative writing, but Africana Studies was my minor. And I was reading all of these wonderful works by all of these Black luminaries, from Frederick Douglass to Harriet Jacobs to W.E.B. Du Bois and so forth. And in these entire narratives, past, present, and future, it was curious to me why the Black queer figure doesn't really show up until the Harlem Renaissance period. Just out of the ether, suddenly, is this idea of Blackness and queerness meeting at an intersection. And that led me to think, well, where were these people before the Harlem Renaissance, and why is there no mention of them? So I went searching the canon for any such references, and found in Incidents in the Life of a Slave Girl by Harriet Jacobs, a scene in which a plantation owner rapes a male slave. And then in literature, I found in Toni Morrison's Beloved, she has an entire scene where the character Paul D is sexually assaulted by a male overseer. And I thought, well, yes, but what about love? Could not find any examples of love during these times. And because Toni Morrison herself said, if you cannot find the book you wish to read, then you must write it. I set about the daunting task of writing it. And I was terrified to do so. I was absolutely terrified to do this because I had no source to draw from, number one. And number two, I was afraid of how people might receive the very idea of Blackness and queerness being put in a historical context like this one.
Especially on a plantation, you mean, yeah?
Especially on a plantation, because in very many ways, for Black people, slavery, this antebellum slavery period, is something that's sacrosanct, and is also very difficult to confront, because there's so much pain involved. And for me to suggest that there could have been what we call queerness at work during that period, some might find offensive, because what goes hand in hand with that is a critique of Christianity. I was afraid that people might find it sacrilegious.
I just found this on your Facebook page. It looked like it was from the book cover, but it's a little thing you wrote. Dear reader, there's often a sense in writers that the work is never good enough, can never be good enough, but we continue to write because it's beyond our control. I didn't know if the story of the prophets could be told, or rather, I didn't know if I could be the one to tell it. Not only was the subject matter too uncharted, but the psychic weight of it felt too heavy to dredge up, but I kept hearing whispers. Can you tell us about the whispers and some of the other, I don't know, challenges, I guess I'd say, that you had in writing this book?
One whisper in particular led to my inclusion of the ancestral voices in the novel. I awoke from a dream, maybe at 2-3 o'clock in the morning, and I keep on my nightstand by my bed a notepad and a pen, because often inspiration strikes at the most inopportune times. And so I scribbled down in the dark whatever it was that was said to me, and went back to sleep. Forgot about it until morning, when I looked at the pad and said, okay, let's go ahead and come into my office and open up the manuscript and write whatever it is that I was writing in the middle of the night. And I looked at it and I read it, and it said, you do not yet know us. And I thought, well, this doesn't go with anything that I'm writing in the novel currently. This sounds to me like a direct address, like it's talking directly to me or to the reader, or maybe even to the other characters. Is this the ancestors' way of saying, we need to have a voice in this because there are some things we have to say? So I rolled with it, and I began to write around this ancestral voice, which came in interspersed between the chapters in which the characters from the plantation themselves are having their own say. What was interesting about including the ancestral voice was that it then led me to another place. There's a chapter in which the ancestors say, this is not the beginning, but here is where we shall begin, which then led me to question what that meant. What I interpreted that to mean was that slavery, antebellum slavery, is not your beginning. You have a whole entire history before that, and we would like to share that with you. And that is why there are chapters in which a pre-colonial African society is given voice and shape, and which Samuel and Isaiah have sort of a precursor in two characters by the name of Elewa and Kosai, so that Black queerness in the literary imagination is not something that's just a figment of American modernity, but it is something that has an ancient history.
And you did a fair amount of research into pre-colonial societies in Africa, right? Can you tell us a little bit about that? And, you know, because I have read those sections about these the village, the female king, and her wives who are both male and female. But what did you learn from this research that you did? And I assume this is based on that. So that's, I suppose you've made this particular community up, but it could have been real. Is that right?
That is right. The Kasongo people that I talk about in the Prophets are an amalgamation of all of the things I learned about various pre-colonial African societies during my research. So I grew up here in America, raised in Brooklyn, New York, educated by an American education system with a Western point of view about things like gender identity, and sexuality. And so I grew up thinking that what I was taught was universal. Imagine my surprise at discovering that in pre-colonial African societies, they had an entirely different understanding of how those things worked, and that the Western constructions were just that, a construction, and not something that sprouted out of nature. So I discovered in some of these pre-colonial African societies, for example, king was simply a title, and whoever held that title was king, irrespective of their genitals. And I discovered also via oral histories, in particular, Esther Arma, who is from Ghana and is a brilliant artist activist. She told a group of individuals that if you had asked her great-grandparents, for example, what is a homosexual? Do you have that here? They would have said, no, we don't know what that is, and we do not have that here. And she said, you would have walked away believing then that there were no such things as homosexuals in Ghana. But if you had explained to her great-grandparents what you meant by homosexual, they would have said, oh, you mean love. Because in her culture, there was no need to distinguish heterosexuality and homosexuality. It was all considered a part of nature, natural part of the landscape. Transgender, cisgender, what have you, that was just all part of the community, and there was no need to give it its own title or category. Right. That freed me in a great number of ways to not only give Samuel and Isaiah life and love, but to go back further to explain that the way we practice homophobia and other anti-queer paradigms currently have their origins in a particular and peculiar type of European colonization and Christian missionary work. And if we want to practice what we call pro-Blackness in current times, then we have to realize that any bigotry toward LGBTQIA plus people is a form of anti-Blackness, because we are practicing what we were taught by our enslavers. Mm-hmm.
You're hearing Out in the Bay, Queer Radio from San Francisco. We're an independent production, by the way. We receive no funds from NPR nor the radio station, so please consider a donation at outinthebay.org. That's outinthebay.org. I'm Eric Jansen, speaking with Robert Jones Jr., the author of The Prophets, a New York Times instant bestseller and one of the Oprah Magazine's 32 LGBTQ books that will change the literary landscape in 2021. You just mentioned the religion and the force that religion has had on queer communities throughout time and all around the world. Well, the name of the book is The Prophets, and that's with a PH, not an F, folks. There are characters in the book with biblical names, and titles of the chapters even have a lot of biblical references. Why did you do that?
One of the reasons why was because giving them Christian names, the characters' Christian names, illustrated the ways in which these previously African peoples were stripped of their culture. So you have a name that you were given by your parents or your community or your tribe, and it had a particular meaning. And the act of being renamed by your captors is another way of subjugating you, of erasing your previous identity and stamping another one on top of it that is one meant to demean you or to make you inferior. So in that same way, Christianity functioned to make us look at our own indigenous African practices as primitive or ungodly or sinful or, you know, quote unquote, black magic, things that are all negative. And I wanted to address the ways in which Christianity functions as a tool of oppression. And in particular, for LGBTQIA plus people, Christianity and many other religions as well, not just Christianity, but in this American context, primarily Christianity, is the philosophy that leads us to believing that it's okay to look at your black transgender sister and decide that you should destroy her when she belongs here. She is a natural part of this world, in this existence, and she deserves basic respect because she exists. Mm-hmm. But Christianity operates as an obstacle to that. And I kind of wanted to touch upon that in ways both direct and metaphorical.
One of the, main drivers of the plot in The Prophets is how another enslaved man there, Amos, has decided for whatever reason that he wants to get on the master's good side and decides that he should become a preacher. And so he gets this position, and then he uses that to slowly turn some of the other enslaved people on the plantation against Samuel and Isaiah. How does Amos become an illustration of what's wrong?
One of the most horrible things about white supremacy, capitalism, and patriarchy is the way in which it gets the people who are subject to that victimization to turn against one another. It pretends that resources are limited so that we have to fight and scramble over them, and also gain the favor of the overlords by any means necessary. Amos sees an opportunity to protect someone that he loves by throwing someone, because he actually loves Samuel and Isaiah too, but sees an opportunity, if he can just convince them to go along with the program, he can protect somebody else. So he's in what he sees as a no-win situation. I'm going to use Christianity as a tool to protect someone that I love, and at the same time ingratiate myself to the power brokers so that maybe I can make things a little bit easier for the rest of us. But I will have to sacrifice you, Samuel and Isaiah, or your love, in order to accomplish this, and I want you to do that willingly.
Right.
Because I want you to see the bigger picture. And it very much so mirrors a lot of modern behaviors, because a lot of the modern behaviors that we see, for example, in someone like Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas, who votes against the interests of black people whenever he has the opportunity, more so than even Antonin Scalia did. So there's a deep self-loathing going on there. That's what happens when you internalize white supremacist capitalist patriarchy. You begin to believe that the damage you're doing to your community is justified, and that you're actually doing something good for your community. And that is the position that Amos finds himself in.
Last thing I want to ask you about, because this also comes up throughout the book, it's about memories. For one thing, there's blood memory, which a lot of the women in the book talk about. And then there's also discussion of, I think this is more true with the men, that there's a thing about not conjuring up bad stuff from the past, because how is it going to help you anyway?
They are the two competing forces when we're confronting trauma. Blood memory, and I think we're beginning to see this in the study of epigenetics, that you can literally pass down the trauma generation to generation for hundreds of years. And then you have on the other side the people who are saying, why dredge it up? Because it's already been experienced in the past, let's move forward. We even see that in the way Joe Biden is trying to approach certain things, where he's saying, okay, you know, we have to move forward. But you cannot move forward. It is impossible to move forward unless you heal the thing that you're trying to move away from. You can't have an open wound that's infected and say, well, just put a Band-Aid on it, because eventually it will have consequences on the rest of that limb. Mm-hmm. You have to address the wound, you have to dress the wound, and you have to heal it before you can move forward. And those are the competing forces. And it's really hard to ask people to confront pain, because pain is you know, human beings run from pain. It's a natural response. But I think it, at the same time, is the only way we'll ever be able to evolve and get to a place where we can actually look at each other as human beings and be respectful and say thank you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that description just brought a little bit of tears to my eyes right there. As you, it reminded me of the scene shortly after Samuel and Isaiah have endured a humiliation and a lashing, and the women are trying to heal them with herbs, and they're saying, you know, this is going to hurt, but you gotta, it's going to hurt some more before you can get through to that spot where you will be healed or approach, go in the direction of healing. So yeah, that's very powerful.
Absolutely.
I want to close with one very brief thing here. In the back of the book, I've never seen so many acknowledgments in a book as this, but the very last few lines: to the entire African diaspora and all marginalized peoples everywhere, together we can create a movement. Together we can smash injustice. Love makes us capable of both things. And I think that's a beautiful way to end it. You've talked about, you know, in various places in your writing, like love is, you know, you can't get anywhere without having some love in there. For example, your inspiration for the book, there was queer sex, but it wasn't consensual. So now you're talking about, what about love? Let's talk about love. And that's what you had to find in this book to write about. No other book was there. You had to write it.
It is the most transformative force that human beings will ever imagine and ever engage in. And it is so important, and it is central to everything that I write. Love is the thing that will take us to where we need to go.
Thank you very, very much. You've been listening to Out in the Bay. My guest this half hour was Robert Jones Jr., author of the book, The Prophets. Thanks for joining me, Robert.
Thank you so much for having me.
To learn more about Robert and his book, check out our website, outinthebay.org, where we will post links about Robert, The Prophets, and Son of Baldwin. That's outinthebay.org, where you can also hear this show and past shows and share them with friends, please. And please also sign up for our weekly email newsletter. You can also subscribe to Out in the Bay via Stitcher and Apple Podcasts. We're an independent production. We receive no financial support from the radio stations that air Out in the Bay, nor from NPR, and certainly not from the podcast platform. So we rely on listener support. Please consider a contribution of any amount to help us keep bringing queer air to your ears. Just hit the donate tab on our website, outinthebay.org. This week's show is produced by Kendra Klang and edited by Porfirio Rango. Thank you both. And our theme music was written by Holly Mead. Thanks to Holly, and thanks to KALW 91.7 FM and San Francisco Press and its radio station, KSFP 102.5 FM, for bringing us back on the air. Want to join our team? Email us at outinthebaysf@gmail.com. That's outinthebaysf@gmail.com. Thanks for joining us. I'm Eric Jansen, and this is Out in the Bay.